Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, Greek has a non-default default. Apple's big news is coming this week. China targets a mere 7.5% in their GDP moving forward. And our guest today is Josh Brown. He is with Fusion Analytics, and he writes for the blog Reform Broker. And all this and so much more on episode number 253 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and it is the first week of March 2012. And I thought it was, with all the things going on, a little bit of a light music and a light atmosphere would be good because some of the stuff is downright silly. I mean, when we're looking at Greece saying that, well, not Greece, but really the body that encompasses the CDS, which is the insurance that protects against default, you know, so we have these credit default swaps. It was deemed that, at least first round, that there's no default because, well, there was a voluntary haircut that was taken. Now, mind you, we know that voluntary haircut of about 70% or so was really mandatory. And somehow it was ruled that the trigger was not there for the CDS. And then when that happens, it really messes up the whole markets. You know, I talked about this many times that I have this big concern that, you know, when you have a market that is based on some kind of rule, law, logic, precedent, history, what happens when all of a sudden the rug is pulled out from under them? And them, I mean the investors who relied on the CDS to protect them against the loss. Now, if you let's set this up. If you were a person that was going to buy a bond and you thought, well, that's a risky bond. And what I want to do is I want to hedge it. I want to make sure that if there's a default, I'm covered. So maybe you spend 1% of the price of the bond. Maybe it's one time, maybe it's annual. Again, just setting this up. And you know you're going to get about a 5 or 6% yield on it. So you take a little bit less, but you know that you're not going to have that chance of default because if it does default for some reason, you'll be paid the insurance. Kind of like very simply buying car insurance. You hope you never need it, but if you do, you know it's going to be there and pay. Well, can you imagine having a situation where all of a sudden there was a car accident and the insurance company said, well, you know, in our definition, that really wasn't an accident. That really wasn't a collision. That, you know, that was more of, I don't know, you had to be just a little bit worse. Or something bizarre like that. And all of a sudden, the whole idea of buying insurance is out the window. Now, at the same time, you'd be reluctant to get a car as well because now you have all this risk outstanding. So if we go through this and there is the final definitive answer by the voting party, I think it's next week, they're going to vote again because it was voted once and then it was, well, of course, a lot of people were upset, so they're going to bring it back to a different vote on a different level. Now, this comes on the heels of Moody's downgrading Greece to the lowest rating possible. The week before, S&P downgraded to a selective default, which we still have no idea what that exactly means. You know, they have to put these modifiers in front of everything to, I guess, make us feel better. Now, we're seeing that there's another vote going to happen again next week. Can you believe that this whole Greece thing isn't just done somehow? Whether they default, whether they pull out of the European Union, whether they get the money, whether, I don't know. But this dragging on forever. At this point, investors, though, don't care. Don't you agree? I mean, it's almost a joke. Every time there's some bad news, there's good news that follows. Somebody says that, well, growth isn't going to be that good. And then somebody says, well, it's going to be a lot better than this. And investors are getting ping-ponged all over the place. So anyway, The point about the Greece thing is we're going to see more of this next week, and I'm certain it's going to be more the week after that and the week after that. So if, you know what? I'm taking it off the plate unless there's something really happens that's very, very, very noteworthy, something that really is going to be changing of conditions. And I don't know if that's a capitulation on my part and saying, hey, you know what? It doesn't matter anymore. It matters a whole lot. It matters in a much bigger way than just this whole Greece disaster. It matters in the fact that sovereign bonds, while the price of the bonds have gone up dramatically in Europe, a lot of that has to do with this amazing amount of money that the European zone has placed on the table. Right now, there was a, I guess it was supposed to be about 400 billion euros, and it went as high as, I think, 550, like close to $750 billion of money was laid on the table last week. Now, what's going to happen with that? The banks are going to take that, and they're going to probably buy some of the sovereign debt. Now, the only problem with that is, well, while it helps in the beginning and it helps the situation to prop up the debt, what does it do on the back end? On the back end, what it does is it creates a double leverage because now the money that's being used is being funneled through. And all this is because there are rules that say they can't invest directly in sovereigns. So what they're doing is essentially doing a handoff with a shake and a wink, and they're saying, hey, you know what? We'll give you all this money, and maybe you'll help strengthen the region out. That's really what's happening. So enough with that. Apple just won't go down. Well, that's good. It went down one day, but it just won't go down because everybody's so excited about the fact that they have $100 billion in cash. They may pay a dividend. Everybody's talking about the dividend. I'm not of the dividend camp. Apple, they're just too smart for that. They're not going to play those games. It's not like they have to pay a dividend so that more companies, more mutual funds, more hedge funds that are by virtue of their overall discipline and strategy and possibly written into their investment process that they have to buy dividend-producing stocks, and Apple then doesn't qualify. So does Apple really need that? No. I mean, Apple is the most widely held. It's the largest company in the world by market cap, by a nice margin at this point. And I don't think that that's really something that's going to – I mean, it may happen, but I don't think it's that necessary for Apple to do so. Well, they're talking about coming out with the iPad 3 with a better resolution screen and a quad-core processor and all these wonderful things. I'm sure we'll talk about that at length on DH Unplugged this week. Make sure to listen to that. We always talk about these various new things that are happening, and it's next week it's going to happen. So Apple should if Apple does what Apple usually does – they're going to be running up into the announcement, and then possibly just, you know, there'll be some people that will be disappointed about one part or another. But the fun will really happen when the device, which comes out somehow in a preview or somehow in a discussion, they talk about some of the things that they'll have in it, and you will see the peripheral companies, the companies that make the cameras or maybe that will make some of the processors or anything, they will move dramatically on speculation that they're in or out of the newest device. So you'll see that happening. I'm pretty excited about that. It would be nice to see the new screen, a little bit of faster processor. My son was at a conference this weekend, and he took my iPad. And while I miss my son a lot over the weekend, I got to tell you something. It was really weird that I didn't have that with me because I read all my magazines, my newspapers, and all that right on there. But what's more interesting about that is, and if I may, just for a moment, kfell, as my grandmother would say, about my son, he's in 10th grade, and he has a program that he's in. It's called DECA. And DECA, you may or may not have heard of this. It's a high school program that is involved in the area of management and business and education. It's a class, but it's also I don't want to say a club, but it's an organization. So what happens is in this class, they learn all about business, and they learn about all about marketing, and they learn about the whole world outside of basic book knowledge that they get in all classes. And they could take that for all of the years they're in high school. And you could actually build a strategy to present as a selling strategy or maybe even a marketing strategy for competitions. And they encourage this. So he went to the regionals, and he came in third place on the regionals. He was actually he planned a wedding. And there's about, I don't know, maybe 25 different topics of things, not only of planning things, but also of different management versus the selling versus You know, maybe human relations and employment issues, and there's also design of there's a whole bunch of things that go into this. Anyway, he was in the one that was the sales representative of a hotel, and he had to plan a wedding, so he planned his whole wedding and all that, and he did the presentation on the iPad for the judges. And again, I told you he came in third place in the regionals. He just came in fifth place in the state. And now he's going to nationals. And nationals is big. There's like, I think they go from about 2,000 participants in the states to about 15,000 participants. So he competed against 80 of the best in the state of Florida for this one. He got that. So, but the point was that how cool is it that now you're even able to incorporate this kind of device, this audiovisual, you know, small form factor. And that's what's going on, obviously, with Apple, that it's just, you know, it's just dominating the market because they did such a great job, and they did. No question about that. China, let's talk about that a little bit. China has been slowing down. There's no question about that. Their ISM non-manufacturing number, their service index, came out light in the contraction zone again over the weekend. Their ISM last week came in a little bit higher than the month before, about a 51. And what's happening is that they're clearly slowing, and they're not really desirous of doing too much to expand because they know they have an inflation problem. They know that they have a housing situation. But meanwhile, the bank lending on a year-over-year basis that came out over last week, what we saw, enormous amounts of money that's still being lent. So, you know, what are they doing with that money? Well, they weren't really putting it in their stock market for a while. Maybe they were buying some homes, but that was being clamped down on. So there's a lot of money being swashed around in the markets. And we saw that Japan did an incredible amount of stimulus. Obviously, the U.S. is doing stimulus all over the place. We see Europe with that $700 billion last week. You wonder why the markets are going up? You want to do all this number crunching and say, oh, let's see, earnings are good and that, and then they don't, you know, we have the economic. You know what? Forget it. Really, think about it. The amount of money that is being pressed into these markets with low interest rates, zero interest rates, with stimulus in the hundreds of billions of dollars is really what's happening. Now, I find it really interesting that China, though, which was thinking about an 8.5% GDP, is now projecting a 7.5%, and we'll see what happens. Because it's not like they're projecting a 7.5% and saying that they're going to add stimulus. They're saying that they're trying to bring this down, and there's a lot of concern over their trading with Europe, one of their biggest trading partners. And they have been slowing down dramatically. So that's kind of what's going on over in China. A couple other things I want to mention to you, and then we'll get to our guest. But there's a big week of there was a big week of economics here in the U.S. last week, and we saw the jobs numbers of initial claims again holding at that about 350 level, which is good. We saw some manufacturing numbers come out. We saw the prices paid shoot up, meaning the input prices really moved up higher, and that was a really We'll see. That there's one of two things that happened there. When input prices go up, what happens is that it's either passed along to you and me, or it's going to be hurting on their margins for companies because it's going to be passed around up the chain. Now, right now, from what I can tell, is the first choice that has been passing it on to the consumer is really what's going on. Have you noticed how, and I don't know, it just seems to be creeping up very quickly lately, that prices have really gotten out of whack. I see restaurants have been increasing their prices dramatically. Let's not even talk about gas, which has skyrocketed over the last 4 weeks. But clothing and just every essential basically has gone up so dramatically. The only thing that hasn't gone up is the inflation number, which is obviously a little bit nutty. But prices are going up. And now we have this other situation where we have gas approaching $4. Now, you remember what happened last time gas approached $4? And oil isn't even at the price it was at that time. Oil is now at about, what, 106, 107 a barrel here? But yet gas is at the high, close to the high. There's a place in Orlando that, right by the car rental place, of course, ripoff artists, that have gas now at $6 a gallon. Now, meanwhile, we're not going to talk about the opportunity we have in natural gas. Natural gas is edging down again last week. There was a little bit of a build. But the natural gas stocks and the oil-related stocks, did you take a look at some of the things we talked about with Frankie last week? Frankie mentioned a few. I mentioned a few. Westport Innovations, wow. amazing number. He mentioned LNG. I was also hot on clean energy fuels. They had a great moves last week. They came down towards the end of the week, but boy, they were really moving up. WTI, I mentioned a few times, that really came down on Friday, but they are just skyrocketing lately. You saw also CLR, Continental Resources, another great oil play, domestic oil play. These are the plays that you want to be near, I think, because even if oil does come down a bit, the fact is that the potential is there to have a substantial amount of you know, rise over the next number of years. And what's going to happen there? Well, we're going to need to have oil. We'll need to have natural gas. We need to have alternative energies. And we're not going to run our cars on solar power or wind power, unless you're going to go to the Great Salt Flats with a, you know, one of those wind-driven – those are cool. The kind of sail cars. What do they call them? Sailing you know, they have a sail. They put a big sail on two wheels or four or three wheels, and these things go like 50 miles an hour down the salt flats. But what you want to look for right now, the energy plays are very, very strong, and that could change, of course. But they are, I think, very opportunistic, in particular the ones here domestically that are in the fracking and in the oil and gas business. Let's see. When there was something interesting that happened there. Oh no, I want to let me back up. Because I kind of got away from the discussion of economics. Next week, this week coming up, we have a big week also, because at the end of the week, we have the employment numbers. Now, the closer we get to the election, the more important this gets and the more opportunity they have to do their best to, you know, pump the numbers as best as possible. But right now, we're going to see on Wednesday the ADP numbers, of course, and then we're going to see the all-important NFP numbers at the end of the week. They're looking at about an 8.3% unemployment rate unchanged, which is not good, but it's much better than it's been. It's come down pretty strong. And also, they're looking for about a 200,000, 210, I think it is, on the payroll gains. And that would be pretty good. Now, I don't think, and I could be wrong about this, we're going to see a surprise like we saw last month. That was just out of control. But clearly, the better we have employment here, the more the opportunity is for retail investors to get back in the market, which, by the way, they have been pulling money out of equity funds for the last, I don't know, like 15 months. There hasn't been a month of net inflows on the positive side to equity funds over that time by the retail investor. So, but when they do start seeing the economics get better, and when you see that happen, the rest of the world looks at us as a very strong opportunity, and with low interest rates holding for some time. So, you know, that's kind of also the play of what's happening on the big picture when it comes to the markets, not any individual stock, but the markets. But we have this coming out, and this is going to be a big issue. So you're going to see some volatility, I think, pick up into the mid part of the week, because there'll be a lot of people positioning for this. You got the beginning of the end of the month window dressing and the beginning of the month pension push into the market's kind of over now. And that's now going to be all of a sudden a big issue coming up towards the end of this week. So keep your eyes peeled on that. And I just want to mention, Wynn, did you see what happened with Wynn Resorts? There was an errant filing that was published talking about how they got this deal in Asia to expand and to develop, and the stock started really running up pretty well. Now, nobody knew that it was a mistake at that point. Then they halt the stock. Stock was halted for probably a good hour. It comes out that that filing was retracted. It was not meant to be filed. It was a mistake. Now, here's something interesting. So I was looking at all the different news items, and I was looking at the various trading, we'll call them squawkers that we have and we listen to, and all the various feeds. And everybody says, you know, when Wynn opens up again, boy, they're really going to tank. You know, it was up about 5% prior. And now all of a sudden they're denying this, and there was an errant filing. And I started thinking about that. That's really kind of interesting. It's an errant filing. It's not just a bogus news item. We're talking about it. Somebody mistakenly filed something with, you know, as a disclosure document. So stock is closed, it opens up, and sure enough, it goes down about 4 points immediately. But it was maybe, I don't know, 2 minutes, and the stock turned around and then went to the highs again for the day. And why is that? Because that doesn't make any sense, at least when you think about it at first. Well, obviously, somebody had that filing prepared, and a clerk submitted it when they shouldn't have. Now, whether or not they submitted it because for whatever reason, and whether they retracted it because it wasn't true, or they weren't ready to do it, the investing world thinks, hey, you know what? They have this thing ready. And obviously, they just put it in too early before it was, whether it was allowed and timing, whatever it was. And so the stock moved up dramatically. And the reason for that was because investors are believing that this is going to happen. And the errant filing was just a mistake in timing of when this would be filed. Kind of an interesting little tidbit there of what happened. So sometimes you can't believe all the headlines and you have to kind of read between them. And it's not always that easy. Some of the stocks we mentioned, and last week I want to go over with you. We mentioned this on Trigger at Trigger Trading on our free version of Trigger Point Research. Which, by the way, please take a look at the site. It should be up, I think, Monday at 12 in the afternoon. We're going to have that running, and we're going to start continuing with our live trigger trades. And you're going to be able to have the opportunity to subscribe to the alerts. The reports will be coming in about 3 to 4 weeks. And those are going to hit for earnings season anyway, because those are earnings reports. We're going to have an ETF rotation model for international. We're going to have also a sector rotation model and a market timing model that is a monthly subscription. But this is something that you've asked me about for a while. Hey, can you get me that research that you have and that, you know, the information on the stocks? And, you know, maybe because you want to manage your own money and, you know, you kind of want to do it yourself, or you just need some trading ideas. Well, we did a partnership with this group called TAS Professional. Wow, they have some of the best technical indicators that I've ever seen on a professional level. And you can't get them on a retail level from what I see. And we integrated that with some of our fundamental work, and we worked with them for the last several months on putting together something. And the first thing we're coming up with is this alerts, where these are going to be technically driven. There'll be some fundamentals, but technically driven, momentum driven, where stocks have an opportunity to either move up, very simply break out, or break down, or even bounce. Because we have these very refined indications of where buying and selling is, where the buying and selling support and resistance levels are, much different than just a simple support and resistance level. And some of the charts we have will show you that as you take a look at the site. But basically, what's really interesting is that if you've been following some of the things that we have been tweeting about, and we'll continue with that, but you're not going to get all the tweets and all the different things that come for subscribers, but you know, you'll get some things and you'll get a flavor for what's happening over at Trigger Trading at Twitter. But basically, we talked about Quest Corp. Did you take a look at that? We talked about that several times and said, you know what, if it hits this price, it's going to hold, it looks like. If it breaks down below that, you need to move away. But it bounced, it bounced, it bounced, and then the earnings came out, and it was about 15% after that. Shutterfly, we talked about weeks ago. We had a small position there, and we held it here for our clients. And they are actually buying some of the assets of Kodak. And the stock was up about 17% on Friday. That was kind of neat. We also talked about some of the natural gas plays, and we talked about some of the pricing there. Triple M, 3M. We talked about Goldman Sachs. That was looking like they were going to break out. And sure enough, they did after that CDS trigger was said to not be happening. And these are the kind of things you'll get. You know, you get very simple, whether through SMS texting right to your phone or email or on our website. You'll get instantaneous information about what is potentially breaking out. You're not going to get 10, 12 a day. That's not what's happening. What we're doing is we're looking for high conviction areas of a stock that they will move. And there's a lot of different components that go into that. And we're looking for short-term trades, maybe you know, something like, we'll say, a couple of days to a couple of weeks. So this isn't day trading. We don't have a setup for that. We have it set for a decent move, an outside move, outsized move over a period of time on a, we'll call it a daily time basis, a daily time frame. So you need to do yourself a favor and check that out, because it, you know, just a couple of ideas could make you some money, hopefully. I mean, you could lose money here too, but I think it's a pretty cool thing, and I know you asked me for this, so we have it happening. I'll also mention that this episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting has some great things available for you. You can simply just, you know, click on it and have a meeting with anybody at any time, anywhere. And what's nice about it is it's not hard to set up. There's nothing to really do in terms of program filing and setting up and all that. You can record it. You can see people face to face. You can actually have chats. You can show your desktop. You can actually show a document. You can share and collaborate. I mean, just amazing. And the reason why I say that is because, I mean, honestly, I use it all the time. I told you this 100 times, and I use it a lot with studying with my son. You know, even by the way, when we're you know, in the same house, sometimes we'll do some studying because we can actually do things on a computer where he has his information, I have mine, and we can do things together that way. And we can talk, and we can chat, and we can share. Neat stuff. What you can do is you get 30 days of free GoToMeeting over at GoToMeeting.com. All you have to do is click the little button that says try it free and use the promo code podcast. At GoToMeeting.com, use the promo code podcast, and you'll get 30 days of free GoToMeeting. We're going to get with our guest, and when we get back, I just want to give you a couple of things you need to look at this week in terms of making sure that you are you know, getting all those trigger trades that we've talked, trigger trading at Twitter, or the trigger point research information. By the way, the site is Trigger Point Research. We'll put links on it to it for, on this particular show notes. And that's a kind of place that we have all of the various blog posts that will be up there, the various information about the earnings reports and all that. It's kind of a flow of information that's going to go there. And then, again, subscribers can either get the information there or they can actually get it right on their phone instantly when the alert is hit, and then it'll link you right back to the site to see the charts and all the things you want to do there. All right, so with that, let's get to our guest. All right, joining us now is Josh Brown, and he is what's known out there as the Reformed Broker. He's the author of Backstage Wall Street. He works with my good friend, actually, Barry Ritholtz over at Fusion Analytics, and he is a blogger, and he has lots to talk about, and I have lots to ask him. Josh, what's going on?
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So, I don't know where you're even to start, but I was thinking about starting off with, you know, the book's coming out, this Backstage Wall Street, and it's a kind of a, you're pulling up the skirt a little bit, you're showing a little bit about what goes behind there. I thought what we'd do is tell me a little bit about what your background is that you were able to get this kind of viewing that you can now, I guess the best way to describe it is expose.
Sure. So my background is in the late 1990s, I was in college, and I started seeing a lot of the older guys that I had grown up with come back home, and they were driving fancy cars, and all they could talk about was how they were working on Wall Street. Turned out that most of them were doing retail brokerage, which used to be a business, and they were doing well for themselves, they were doing well for their clients, the dot-com stocks that they were buying and selling were working. So it really looked like something that I wanted to try and go out and do. You don't really find out until you start a career on Wall Street whether or not you're in the place that you wanted to be, or if you started the wrong way, et cetera. So I think I kind of came into Wall Street through the back door. If I could do it all over again, I might have started out as a trader as opposed to a broker, because that's a little bit more interesting to me. But ultimately, I started out in the brokerage arena, and I paid my dues, and I worked my way up to branch manager at several independent firms. But what I ended up realizing, and 2008 helped out a lot, was that really that's not the way to manage money for people. Nobody actually needs a stockbroker to sell them investments, especially in this day and age when people have market access online, et cetera. So the book is a dual story. And it's half my story, I guess, my evolution from when I started to what I'm doing now, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is a little bit more fee-based investment advisory. But I also, the parallel story running through the book is the history of Wall Street-Main Street relations, how it came to be that almost everyone in the country has some kind of relationship with finance and the stock market. So I think those two stories dovetail kind of nicely, and I hope people like the book.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing. When it comes to, and I wrote about this in my book, actually, the first book, The Disciplined Investor, I wrote about how, you know, there's different ways that you can do things when it comes to investing. There's different kinds of brokers. When I say brokers, I don't mean stock brokers. I mean, like a Schwab or a Merrill. Or, you know,
sure,
back,
sure.
There's different types of ways that you can work with an actual investment advisor, whether it's a fee-based or it's a fee-only, or if it's a percent of the assets plus a bonus, or if it's just commission. And one of the things I found really interesting was that, you know, over the last couple of years, maybe even the last, I would say 5 years, there's been a real big change, and I think the realization of individuals is, wait a minute, let me get this straight. So I'm going to buy an investment because you recommend it. And the only time I'm going to hear you again from you again is either because you're trying to fill up your, you know, your tank again with commissions, or you know, I end up holding this forever. Or on the other hand, I'm going to just get all sorts of advice from you because you're going to want to churn my account. Is that? Can you explain some of that and how that what you got out of that? Because I know you're kind of you know, you have something to say about that.
So 93% of Americans that were polled in 2010 said that they have no idea that there's a difference between a stockbroker and a financial advisor. And this is very scary. And basically, there are two different standards of care. One is the broker's standard of care. The broker is governed by FINRA, and the standard of care there is a suitability standard. So, Andrew, as long as I sell you an investment that you're, that's suitable for you, meaning you're wealthy enough and you have the risk tolerance that you can handle it, then I've done my job and I've lived up to my responsibility. But that doesn't govern the holistic nature of what a financial advisor is supposed to do, where, you know, somebody thinks they're getting advice that's good for them, that's good for their life. They're not. What they're really getting is a product sold to them from time to time, or sometimes a broker recommending a trade or whatever the case may be. So the financial advisor has to live up to a heightened standard, which is called the fiduciary standard. The fiduciary standard is no matter what the advisor does, it has to be in the best interest of the client, plain and simple. So if they're recommending a product, it's got to be the lowest cost, best available version, not the one that pays the highest commission. Suitability is there, but it's not even close to as important as the fiduciary responsibility. So most people don't know that there are two different things, and what muddies the water even further is that most financial services professionals, especially at the large firms, are what are called hybrid. So sometimes they're your broker, but sometimes they're your financial advisor. And good luck figuring out which is which when. So those are some of the conflicts that I explore in the book, and there's some of the things that I think are the most confusing to people out there. They really don't understand that there are all these different statutes and rules, and people can kind of live in this gray area between the two.
You know, one of the things that I think is, I think it would be really good, I don't think I've ever, in 200, what are we up to, 250 shows that we've done consecutively, so what is that, 5 years almost, right, 4 years? I don't think we've ever really explored the whole concept of bond commissions. Now, here's something right. that I find fascinating, and I really, you know, I've talked about this a few times with people, and they don't really have any interest in it, but I always found this to be just unbelievable. So here's the deal. Here's the setup. So an individual goes and wants to buy a bond. So let's say bond, whatever. You know, how do they buy bonds? By yield, right? That's how you buy a bond. It's kind of like buying a car by the monthly payment. So So what happens is they go and buy a bond. They say, okay, the broker says, well, we got this bond. It's a 4.7%, blah, 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 20-year bond. And the guy says, well, that's good. That's a good, okay, the rate, okay, fine. You know what? And I'll ask you, because tell people about what's behind.
The broker is selling that from his own inventory.
And what else? How much of his and there's usually no commission on the trade ticket, right?
There won't be a commission printed on the ticket because it's an inside market.
Right.
The broker is getting paid a concession or a spread from the inventory.
And what's interesting about that is, let's say that the real yield, if you could just strip out everything that the broker was getting, would be, let's just say, 4.8%, 10 basis points higher, right? But you spread that out.
I mean, it could be. It depends on the type of bond.
Right,
but
no.
Yeah, definitely.
But I'm just saying, I'm just picking a number. The fact I'm trying to say is that the commission on bonds are so much fatter and so much more potentially abused than stocks than you can imagine. Would you agree?
I don't know if they're fatter. It depends on the broker. So there are full service brokers that are still charging 2.5% on stock transactions.
Well,
You're not getting 2.5% on a bond, but the bond commission is hidden, I think, is your point.
Yeah.
Whereas the stock commission is printed right on the confirm. Your broker charged you X dollars. The bond, the client would have no idea. And what's even more interesting, to take your point a little bit further, is that you could have a fee-based advisor who, when he does fixed income with you, actually is acting as your broker as well. So you're paying him a fee on the entirety of the assets that you have with him, and in the meantime, he's also taking bond spreads when he sells you, you know, a fixed income. So
nice.
It's right. So then it's not really your advisor at all.
Right.
So there's all kinds of stuff like that. I agree with you. It's wacky.
So talk to me a little bit about what's going on these days in the world of like boiler rooms and, you know, kind of the stuff that people need to watch out for and what you have like really learned and some of the things you've kind of talked about in your book.
Yeah, I think the tradition, the stock boiler rooms are gone. There are a very small number of people left who are still earning a living as retail brokers, buying and selling stocks for big commissions. A lot of that's been eradicated. Most of those firms got involved with private placements. They got shut down by regulators, or they ran out of net capital because their business model, there are no clients that are interested in that. Every time they blow up a client, they have to go find a new one, and it's harder and harder to do. So I think that part of the brokerage world is kind of faded and is almost completely extinct. But, you know, there's some next generation stuff going on that I think people should be careful about. The first is anyone calling, cold calling you with shares of Facebook or and Twitter. This is obviously what they're going to gravitate toward next because they know they can sell this to a lot of people. They're building these private funds where you think you're buying shares of Facebook, but what you're really buying into is a private fund that may or may not be able to secure shares of Facebook. You have absolutely no idea what price they're doing it, whether or not the shares are restricted shares. So that's a really weird thing that's going on. I shouldn't be surprised about it. I think the other thing is the currency trading. From what I hear, it's like 95% failure rate. So the come-ons from the online currency sites come and trade through our site, come trade here, we'll give you this much leverage, we'll give you this much. Essentially, those are closed off inside markets. You're not actually trading with the currency world. The broker that you think is your broker is actually your counterparty, and they even put it right in their prospectuses when they went public that essentially the customer's loss is their gain. That's the business model. So I think those two things are really what should be watched out for right now.
So you're saying in that deal where the customer's loss is their gain is not the kind of thing that you would want to be the customer in? What's the point?
There are some people that say it's 100% failure rate. I've also heard that it's 95%. I haven't seen that many empirical studies where I could say I agree that it is, but just the fact that that's even possible, that we could be talking about loss rates like that, tells you really all you need to know.
I'm going with the 5%. I got to tell you why. There's always a shill necessary. Right? There's always a shill necessary to get the thing keeping on going.
Well, no, there are pros. There are guys that really know what they're doing. And then everyone else is just being driven into that because they think that's what they're supposed to. People watch TV and they hear about the U.S. Euro or the crossing with the yen and they think they're supposed to be doing that because that's what the media is telling them. If you look at that, though, what's really happening is the currency firms are sponsoring programming on financial television and in financial websites. The currency firms are putting up money because they're doing so well to get more talk about currency trading out there, and as a result, that's driving people into it that have absolutely no business using leverage and trading currencies at 2 o'clock in the morning for themselves.
Don't say 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 o'clock in the morning is a time that I have a big problem with, by the way, because at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know what happens, right? There is mysteriously a something out of nowhere that spoos spike, Euro spikes, 201.
Right.
It's unbelievable. Go look at a chart. It's unbelievable. Exactly at 2 o'clock, I mean. It's spooky.
But I've not seen that.
I'm usually
sleeping. I have two kids under the age of five.
Listen.
So I try to sleep then.
Sleep? I'm just saying to pull up a chart, the overnight chart. That's what I'm saying.
I will.
So I shouldn't call you at 2 o'clock next time it happens.
Try not to, if you don't mind.
And I have three kids. None of them are that young, but I got to tell you something. Enjoy them while they're this young.
I certainly try.
All right, so let's talk about a little bit about what's going on with the current markets and all that and how you're looking at things. I know that one of the things that we had some time ago, Barry came on when Fusion Analytics, that's the name of the program too, right? Fusion Analytics?
Well, Fusion IQ,
is the ranking algorithm,
and Fusion Analytics is the name of the RIA that I work for.
So when that first came out, we helped Barry Atkin kind of telling people, hey, try this out. Very cool stuff. It's it ties in very similar to what we do in terms of concept. But I know that that was is a great platform to really get I'll call them signals, but also information about positions and all that. What's your kind of, give me the big picture view right now on the world, which seemed to have gotten less nutty for a few weeks there, not because the markets went up, but just because things kind of calmed down. And it seems like things are getting a little strange again.
So I guess I'll start with our positioning and then I'll pull it back and give you an idea of why we're positioned that way. But so we're pretty long and we've been since early January. We did not catch that end of the year Santa Claus thing that started a couple of days before Christmas. It's not that we were out of the market, but we were kind of in a neutral posture. And when January rolled around, we looked at how markets were acting and we decided to get a little bit longer. But the way we've gotten longer is really we've just continued to add to the things that were working last year. We didn't go crazy with small caps or with cyclicals or with specifically economically sensitive things. And so certainly in the first 6 weeks of this year, we kind of looked at it like, all right, you know, maybe we could have done things a little bit differently. We could have been a little bit more weighted toward economic recovery. But in our view and the things that we look at, the jury is still out. When I talk about the things that we look at, in addition to market internals and technicals, which Fusion IQ ranks for us on a scale of 1 to 100, so we can see individual stocks, we can also see ETFs, which give us a view of indexes. But, you know, there are other things that are important. You look at credit spreads to determine the equity risk premium. You want to look at leading economic indicators on a weekly basis, if possible. You want to look at momentum on several different time frames. And so all of these things kind of go into the stew, and they give us some sense of what we want to do posture-wise. So I would say we're pretty long right now. We did a rebalance yesterday for the first of the month. We did take some small cap exposure that we had added throughout the first couple of months of the year. We're not as aggressive as some firms out there that are really looking to shoot the lights out, because basically what we do is work for wealthy people who are not interested in becoming unwealthy. So to us, beating the market is nice, but you know, we have a primary job, and we're not a hedge fund. We're not putting up performance numbers on a billboard. We'd love to beat the market, but you know, ideally, but we can't do that in every environment,
right?
Because in a melt up, it's not our job to be leading the parade down Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
In a melt up, our job is upside capture. Try to grab as much of it as we can without exposing ourselves fully to what happens if it turns. So I think we're positioned correctly at the moment, and we're pretty long. We do have some bonds in all the portfolios, and we're not ever 100% equities, but I like where we are. And again, it's a lot of the same dividend stuff that we were doing last year. That really hasn't changed.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that last year, 2011, it was a monstrosity. You know, just in terms of trying to get positioned, there was no way to get in one way versus the other without getting stopped out and all that. But
as tough as I've ever seen it,
yep.
As long as I'm watching and doing this.
Yep. This year, what's interesting is, and I know that Barry does a lot of coverage, and Barry and writing on the big picture, and you're also very skeptical, just like I am on some things. But you know, we did see, which is, I don't know when I'm going to come to the and this is not necessarily an investing discussion, it's economic, amazing to see how the resilience of the world in the face of a crumbling Europe continued. It's very difficult to me to reconcile that.
So there's a couple of things going on there, and I agree with you, but I think the way to look at this is Europe is not really crumbling. A couple of countries in Europe are crumbling.
Okay.
And that could have an outsized effect on the bigger countries, and that's really the worry. The economy in France and the economy in Germany are not crumbling. The economy in Greece is crumbling, and to a lesser extent other countries. And now that could become like a contagion type scenario for the bigger countries. But I don't know that the entire continent is crumbling. The other thing is, it's the same old, same old. at the end of the day, you know that you ultimately can't fight the Fed. And now we have every Fed around the world.
Right, every Fed.
Pumping
yeah.
Every Fed. It's Fedpalooza. It's
yeah.
China pumping. India's pumping. Brazil lowered rates. All of them. So the ECB is now acting like the Fed, which they said they would never do. Now
right.
they're doing it. So
right.
that's real. I mean, I think that's really the story. It's less complicated this year than people think. This year, all you had to figure out was, okay, they're going to pump. Everyone's lowering rates. China's lowering rates again. India's low. So as soon as you saw the BRIC countries lower rates, Europe lowering rates, and us at the same time holding rates down, some would argue there's some kind of secret pumping. But just if that's what the environment is, it's less complicated than you think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, I think, is why the cyclicals, the technology stuff, that's why that is outperforming when last year it was all about healthcare, utility staples.
You know, the who was it last year? David Tepin. And they called it the Tepin rally and all. He said, listen, here's the deal. This is sometime early, a year and change ago. Here's the deal. If the economy approves, the markets will go up. If the economies don't approve, the Fed will step in. So therefore, the stock market under every circumstance will go up. That was the concept that he had.
God, is that scary?
He said that, but no, it's terribly scary. Terribly, terribly scary. Okay? But he said
we've eliminated the business cycle. Congratulations.
You've eliminated the business cycle. Right. You've eliminated the business cycle, price discovery, and you've eliminated the need for anything other than now the Fed. And by the way, the Fed, in their talk about the wealth effect, has effectively said that they are basically investors in the market.
The wealth effect is BS because,
right. I know.
As we know, the housing market has way more to do with the wealth effect than the stock market. People's exposure to the stock market is minimal when you look at the entire population versus what their exposure is to the price of their real estate.
Right,
but the wealth effect is much more pronounced with housing.
Right, but we have, and by the way, something to talk about is the Fed never really gets into the market like Japan. They invest directly in their stock market. They invest. They blatantly will put money into their markets.
Right. Well, some would argue that by flooding the banks with liquidity, that liquidity has found its way into the markets
right.
one way or the other.
Oh, it has.
So it's almost the same thing.
Right. No, I agree with you. So now, where do we go from here? I mean, the economic surprise index, we did a piece on this last quarter. I don't know if we sent that to you, but about the economic surprise indices and the differential correlation between an economic surprise index tracking it and markets. And right now the emerging markets looked like they had to pick up a bit. The U.S., we wondered, okay, what's happening here if the economics didn't pick up? And meanwhile, we do see that the economic surprise index picked up nicely. And that's even in the face of the Fed, Bernanke, talking down the economy on a constant basis. That's his job these days, I guess, because that's back to more stimulus. But also, I did a study last week. So we have the whole idea of stimulus and economic surprises. How many times the word QE was mentioned on the Bloomberg Terminal over the last, year, let's say, right? And I tracked
yeah.
that. I tracked the mentions with the S&P 500. And I got to tell you something. There's kind of a spooky-dooky correlation there.
Yeah. Well, no, listen. Here's the way you want it. I think what's the worst case? So we saw this Q4 GDP number, and the most distressing part of it is a good number on the surface. But the part that the bears would latch onto is they would say, well, 2/3 of that 3% comes from wholesale inventories. So if the consumer doesn't now step up and buy those things, then those inventories come back out of GDP, and you get and you go lower again. So that's the bear case, is that the consumer is not going to step in and do their part now that we've restocked and we did this big inventory splurge in the fourth quarter. So that's something that you could worry about, and if that's the case, then what ends up happening is this does not become a virtuous cycle, self-sustaining recovery. It starts to taper off in late spring, but you don't really feel the effects until September. That's the bear case, and that's what Barry is looking at right now is our worst case. And that, by the way, that has nothing to do with Europe, which obviously, if there was some kind of massive event, would be a game changer. I'm just giving you the U.S. kind of a but take it a step further. If we, and look at what the best possible scenario would be, that this is self-sustaining, the consumers take their cue from the fact that the Dow is at 13,000. Nothing has blown up in a while now. There's some hiring going on. Unemployment numbers seem to be improving. The biggest problem with that bull case where this is self-sustaining is we can't get out of stall speed. We can't get that 4% GDP number, that 4.5% that pulls you out of stall speed and almost forces people to get back to business and to start rocking and rolling again. That's the frustrating part of a balance sheet recession, is that you don't break above that level that you need to for things to get cooking again. So I laid out the worst case for the U.S., the best case. Let's just say that we're somewhere in between, and then it's choose your own adventure, and really all you have to go on, if you're an investor, is valuations at that point. Mm-hmm. If you say that this is going to be a stall speed, slow recovery, no major negative event, but nothing great to get things cooking, then you're left with, really, valuation. Do I want them at this valuation or do I not? Historic valuations, historically, are not expensive, but they're not the bargain that they were. So if you're a true investor, what you're looking for are these momentary, fear-driven sell-offs in the market. We haven't had one yet in 2012, but that would be the opportunity for you to say, okay, that sector of the market was trading 14 times earnings. Look, it's back down to 12.5. We're buying them here. You know, that's the kind of thing that I think you can accomplish in this tape.
Right, but the thing is that that being the case, everybody, again, once again, the same thing happened a couple of years back, waiting for that pullback. The pullback never happens because as everybody's waiting for the pullback, they have their own
price. I don't think people should. Yeah, let me clarify. I don't think people, we're in. We're in the market.
Right.
We're in.
Right.
We know that the market goes up 3 out of 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
We know that even in the worst, the history of 50% sell-offs in the market is that there have been like
two.
Seven yeah. of them, four of them.
Right.
Everyone is sitting in cash, is looking for the next 50% demolition derby in the S&P. And the reality is they're very, very few and far between.
Right.
And we just had one so recently. And by the way, the data also says when you see a 50% sell-off in the S&P, it doesn't matter what's going on in the market or the military or anything, you close your eyes and you buy it. So
right.
If people are sitting in cash waiting for that 50% haircut in this market, they can get back in, they're really kidding themselves. And if they're sitting in cash waiting for a 5% sell-off to get in, then really what the question is when are you using this money? When is your retirement? Because quite frankly, if it's 20 years from now, does it really make a difference if you started buying at 1370 or 1325? Is that going to change the amount of capital you have when all is said and done and you're now drawing from it?
Yeah.
So I think people have to look more at their own situation and not try to have like a million people pretending to be George Soros. We're not all George Soros. Some of us just have to put money to work and do the best we can.
I hear you. Let's get back to your book real quick on the closing. And again, that's called Backstage Wall Street. When's that coming out? When is it out? Is it out now?
Comes out March 30th. It's available pre-order right now on Amazon. And I heard that the Kindle version just became available yesterday. So I'm really excited.
Good. Now, this is a question I have for you. In terms of all you've learned, and I think one of the biggest things that you mentioned recently was that the days of the traditional broker are numbered.
They've been.
How's that gonna play out?
Do you know the firm taking Facebook public is not allowed to use Facebook?
Really?
It's just over. The days of the broker sitting in a walled garden, sitting in the dark, being fed sell-side research reports to have things to sell to their clients, selling A-share mutual funds at 5.75% to retail investors, all of that is over. And everyone knows it. It's just a matter of time. And I think the story of the book is there's a really awesome, brave new world out ahead of us. But in order for us to get there, we kind of have to learn about all of these little foolish things that are in our way and all the things that cause us to make bad decisions and all the things that cause us to listen to the wrong people. So I tried to make the book funny and exciting and packed with information. And there's a lot of historical stuff in there. There's a lot of stuff about where I think we're going. And I think anyone that reads it is going to come away, with a lot more knowledge than they've ever had before about how Wall Street truly makes its money, how it does its marketing, how it interacts with the public, And that kind of knowledge, I think, will really make people better investors.
And finally, I guess on that, when you look at the world of brokers, I mean, we're seeing a lot of layoffs and financial consolidations, and not to mention the various rules that are, you know, constraining traditional brokers and all that. When we look at TV, I don't care what television station you're looking at or radio, and all, they have all these guests, these this flood of guests that come on with every opinion under the sun, and usually the opinion of whatever the management is kind of trying to, you know, twist and turn. What are we supposed to take away from that when they're pushing this particular stock or thesis or this guy? You know, this guy says, Bernini, oh, we're going up to, you know, $40 billion on the stock market. And this guy says, oh, you know what? We're going down. You got a correction due. And all. What's the whole point of all this prognostication and you know, all this? Is it just self-aggrandizing? Is it just talking their book? What's the deal?
You know, it's tough because I'm part of that now. And, I try to do it in such a way where I'm not driving the viewers crazy and being another one of these guys that just talks nonsense. When I go on, I really try to present the thesis and make a case, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of people do that well. I think the problem is that, you know, the way people consume this stuff, they should be consuming it sparingly, and they should understand that what they're watching is more entertainment than information, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Some people are entertained by sports news. Some people are entertained by political news. It's okay to think business news is fun and interesting and engaging. But if you think the man on TV who's yelling out, you know, 50 stock picks a night is going to help you, it's hard. You're already screwed as an investor, if that's what you think.
I hear you.
You have bigger problems than whatever they're shouting from the TV. You have like a mental problem.
Yeah.
So, I think people should just take it for what it is and enjoy it. And if they don't like it, turn it off.
I hear you. You've been on Fast Money, right?
Yeah, I've been doing Fast Money for a year now. I really enjoy doing
it. How often?
And I think it's one of the better shows.
Fast Money is great. Now it's like a clean slate. We've had everybody on besides. I was up there actually talking with, who hasn't I have it on? Adami's been on, everybody's been on, Karen wasn't, but I guess we're trying to right now, Skybridge, we're trying to get our friend from Skybridge on.
He's, Anthony.
Anthony, yeah, we kind of gone back and forth, we've talked, and we just haven't been able to arrange it. Scaramouche, the Mooch.
Tell him you had Downtown Josh Brown on. He'll
Downtown Josh Brown, he is the author of Backstage Wall Street. He runs the blog called Reform Broker, that's part of the Stock Twiz Network, I know, and he's also with Fusion Analytics, managing money and also doing all sorts of good work over there. Hey, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll make sure to get all that information and all the links and your really handsome picture that looks like a federal agent in front of some kind of a Fed building in this picture, by the way, with the hair parted, with the blue. Listen, this is nice. This is uptown Josh Brown in this picture.
Right.
But we'll make sure to get that all up there so we can, anybody that wants to read the book or find out more about you, we'll get it right from the blog, okay?
Andrew, thanks so much for having me.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
All right.
That was interesting. I think the whole discussion of what really happens, I guess, in the background of all this and how people have been ripped off for so many years. You know, we know it on the inside. We see it because they try to do it to us as investment advisors. And you know, you see that they come at you with prices when you're looking to maybe buy a bond or you're looking to sell a bond. And you're like, are you kidding me? So, you know, what we do here is, for example, when we have a client that has a lot of bonds and maybe we're buying or selling, we'll go out to maybe five different places and get quotes and bids and then to compare it to our system on Bloomberg and find out who's got the best pricing. And it's not always the same guy. It changes from here to here, but sometimes it's big spreads. And with stocks, it's a lot easier because they're not trading like they used to. When we know the market value of the stock, they trade regularly. It's very transparent. But at the same time, you know, you got to watch who's market making underneath you and who's pushing what for what reason. So, you know, and you can make your own determinations. It's better to just have, you know, information available, I think, and then make a determination sometimes than work with somebody who's getting paid only to sell you something, you know, on a commission basis. I've always been very negative about that. You know, you want to work with somebody, you have to be at the same, you know, on a level playing field that, you know, I make money, you make money. Yeah, I make money for administration and all that and managing it all the time. I don't have to trade. I don't have to buy and sell. I can buy and sell. You know, it's a difference between a advisor, I guess, and a broker. So there you have it. Okay, so with that, we're going to wrap it up today, and I want to thank you for joining me. Do me a favor, a couple things. Go over to iTunes and please leave a review. And the other thing is stick around for next week because I have a free book offer, and it involves Trigger Point Research. And we'll put that on the side right now. But just, you know, there's also a two-free-week trial that you can get right now, or when it opens this week, of Trigger Point Research. You get the full program. You get the Trigger Point Alerts, which is the on breakouts, in other words, breaking up stocks that are on the long side, going to move higher that we think, and they're going to break out to some substantial move and short squeeze. You have the bounces, something that's kind of hitting a ceiling and bouncing down for a short, or hitting a low point and bouncing up. And you also have the breakdowns if you want to look at shorting stocks, you know, where that's happening. And then all the other things that we'll talk about. But those you can get for a two-week free trial, and no questions asked if you don't want to renew it. And you just have to go over there and get set up for a subscription. And after the 2 weeks, if you don't want it, you know, you just stop your subscription and say, you know, that's it. I'm not doing it anymore. So, you know, that's kind of cool. And other than that, I think I want to say thank you for joining me. And we'll see you next week. And we'll watch those jobs numbers very closely. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.